Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Chris Newton, who is a war historian and a teaching fellow at the King's Institute for Applied Security Studies. He has a PhD in war studies and is also a former defense policy advisor. So, Chris, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about the King's Institute for Applied Security Studies and what you do there?
Yes. So essentially, I work for King's College London, and King's College London has the School of Security Studies, which houses both the Department of War Studies and the Department of Defense Studies Department. And the King's Institute for Applied Security Studies is mainly housed in the Defense Studies Department, but essentially what we offer are online MA courses in international affairs and global security, and we've just launched an MA in security studies as well. But these are online. These look at, the course I'm particularly teaching on, the international affairs course. We do a whole mixture of military history, international affairs, international relations, and contemporary security and strategic issues as well. So it's a real good opportunity.
Wow.
If you can't do a residential master's program, then, these online programs offer sort of brilliant flexibility.
That's really cool. I definitely would encourage people to check that out. That's cool that you guys do online. Can I ask you what drew you to history and particularly military history?
Well, for viewers, you can probably tell that I have a British accent or an English accent, and I'm British. And what first drew me to history was really kind of learning about, as I think most British people who get into history do, learning about the kings and queens and so forth. So it's really that kind of first sparked my interest in history. And just being fascinated about how they lived in the past and how differently it was to live in different periods of history. What drew me to military history in particular, I think the real kind of turning point, the real moment, was the 50th anniversary of D-Day. And at that point, the TV channels were full of commemorative programs and events and so forth, as it was indeed this year, the 80th anniversary. But back then, I was just fascinated by the stories and what they went through at that time. And, it's just completely unfathomable now that, that people went through such extreme events. So it was really from there that drew me to military history. And then I watched various documentaries growing up.
Oh, yeah.
The World at War is perhaps your viewers might be familiar with. In terms of American documentaries, the Civil War, that was repeated quite a bit in England. And I watched that. And from there on then, I became interested in it, through school, and ended up studying at King's at university.
That's very cool. And, just from an American point of view too, we also kind of, a lot of us seem to get into history studying, Agincourt and the Kings of England. And then you kind of inevitably come across the military struggles and that just sucks you in, so that totally makes sense. That being over in England, you would get in that way too. So I guess the number one question, you probably get this a lot, one of the questions on everybody's mind is World War III, the potential for World War III. Are there any particular events that you see happening right now that you think deserve more attention because they kind of led to one of the world wars that we should be paying more attention to?
In terms of today, in terms of contemporary events or back then,
A World War... Yeah, like, are things happening right now that could lead to another world war that's like...
Definitely. I mean, especially now, we are going through the most dangerous time since the Cold War, or the end of the Cold War. And, you know, there are various events, you know, especially over the past few years, and they're all beginning to interlink as well, which is not good. So you have, you know, the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the growth of Russian military ambitions and Russian expansionism. So you have that, you know, a conventional war in Europe, the kind of war that we haven't seen for a long while in Europe. And it's between, you know, nuclear power and another European state. So that's, you know, that's extremely concerning. And the, you know, potential, you know, Putin keeps, you know, threatening, you know, nuclear weapons and so forth. And, you know, and that has the potential to you know, to really escalate. Then you have, of course, the what's going on in the Middle East with, you know, the 7/10 attacks, the Hamas attacks on Israel, and then the subsequent Israel-Hamas war, which that in itself has expanded. It's, you know, is expanded into, yeah, a confrontation not only between the Houthis in Yemen, a faction in Yemen and Israel, but also it's drawn, you know, the UK, the Europeans, the Americans into attacking Houthi targets, because yeah, the Houthis are attacking merchant shipping. And then of course is expanded to a war in Lebanon as well, which has just happened over the last couple of weeks. Yeah. And of course you have Iranian attacks, yeah, on Israel as well. One in April and one just a couple of weeks ago in the beginning of October. And there are other flashpoints as, yeah, well, as you know, the world's extremely dangerous at the moment. And there's of course China, which is, you know, just mount a drill blockade in an exercise surrounding Taiwan, which is very concerning. And then there's North Korea as well, which we're learning that North Korea has troops in Ukraine and they're providing technical assistance at the moment, but the speculation is that they're going to be used in the fighting as well. So all of these things, you know, all of the various authoritarian powers, they're interlinking, they're gradually deepening their defense cooperation. And it doesn't look good. That's for sure.
Well, I feel infinitely worse now having asked you that question. It definitely seems like it's not just, the war in Ukraine. It's not just one thing. It's all these things that you could easily be something that we look back on. Hey, this might have been part of what caused World War III or something like
and
that.
And the other thing I forgot is that the Iranians are also supplying, you know, in particular drones to Russia to use in their strategic bombardments against Ukrainian cities and so forth as well. So everything's becoming interlinked, and it's worrying.
Totally. It's worrying. Yeah. Let's just use like the less alarming word.
Classic English understatement.
Kind of similar question-ish, kind of in the same realm. Do you see any sort of, so we're studying the American Revolution in the first season of the narrative side of this podcast. So that's why a lot of these questions are kind of be tracking back to the American Revolution in Britain a little bit. Do you see any sort of things going on today that are kind of similar to the background of the American Revolution, sort of like a British colonial territory or colony somewhere overseas that's kind of building up resistance and that might turn into an armed conflict against Britain, maybe? I'm curious.
I don't think it's, you know, what's happening in Britain, for example, or indeed the United States. I don't think it's reached the point, you know, where you're worrying about something on that level. But there are certainly, you know, there are certainly, as you know, you're experiencing in America as well, there are certainly, you know, big feelings of disquiet about how the political system and how politics and politicians in general are conducting themselves and are running government. And you know, we've had, you know, over the summer, for example, riots in this country, which last I think took place over at the beginning of August, which were concerning, and that related to a specific you know, murders relating to, you know, poor innocent girls. But that, you know, that was very quickly politicized. But there are concerns, yeah. You know, there are concernings. You know, politics is becoming, both on both sides of the Atlantic, incredibly sort of polarizing. You know, Republican and Democrats, you know, there's an increasing intolerance there in our politics. You know, it's like the...
Yes.
You know, I come from a conservative perspective, and, you know, sort of my concern is I don't want to be political or, you know, coming from a particular political perspective. But I'm concerned that there are certain, you know, perspectives and certain views which are just not, you know, tolerated, and people can't have, you know, civil discourse without, you know, one side calling each other kind of names or slandering each other, you know, racist and far right, you know, particular kind of insults that are being used. And then there are equivalent, I suppose, woke is the right wing insult on the left, for the left. So there, and of course you've had your problems with January the 6th as well, which was a concerning event. So I mean there's lots of talk. I note there's some talk of, like, oh, will there be another civil war in America and so forth. I mean, I don't know enough, you know, I'm not there in America to really say, but I think that's, you know, perhaps slightly overdoing it a bit. But certainly, even if there isn't, like, rebellions or civil wars or anything like that, I think just the polarization and the increasing, you know, intolerance and the increasing, like, demonization of the other side, where before, like 20 or 30 years ago, that didn't happen as much, whereas now it's concerning. And those are the kind of the seeds that would plant, you know, further kind of difference. And it's like, what, you know, both sides don't see each other as part of the same thing anymore. It's like, you know, these are two very different kind of mindsets.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And just for our American audience too, it's very polarized over in Britain as well, you're talking about, because over in America, it's crazy polarized over there.
And, you know, we had, for example, Brexit, which we in 2016 we had the votes, you know, we were members of the European Union, and in 2016 a majority, 52%, voted against, and that has been extremely emotional, polarizing debate where, you know, where the referendum itself, there was high tensions. You know, it struck a chord about, you know, who we are as Brits and where we see, you know, where we see ourselves in the world today. It, you know, it brings, you know, questions of patriotism to the fore as well. And there was a lot of resistance after the vote to implementing the vote, and there were, you know, which is why there was a subsequent general election. Well, there were two general elections in, you know, 2017 and 2019, because such was the situation was so difficult, and the government was having so much difficulty getting Brexit through, that there needed to be subsequent general elections in order for the Conservative Party to get the majority to ultimately get, you know, their version of Brexit through. So it was a very fierce debate. Yeah. It was extremely divisive, and we're still feeling the effects of that to this day, because the new Labour government are seeking to reopen, you know, what was negotiated and formulate a new deal with the European Union.
That'll be interesting to see the fallout of that. I'm sure it's only going to serve to polarize people even more. You know, it's so funny, kind of studying history for so long, I feel like historians try to get into the mindset of what it would have been like to live at a certain time, in a certain place, and how people thought. And it's almost like an obsessive thing when you study certain periods. And I always remember thinking in the early 20th century in Russia, the idea that you couldn't discuss politics at the dinner table. It was very divisive. And I always felt like, how is that? You know, how did that's so weird. It's so foreign growing up. And now I totally understand it. It's very crazy how it just happens like that. Very fast, it seemed. So that's interesting that you're talking about how it's polarized kind of everywhere now. It's not just over here, over there. It's everywhere. At least in the Western world.
And also, there is a kind of, especially on the right of politics, we're kind of feeling that there are kind of increasing encroachments on freedom of speech, and that there are certain topics or certain views that are not allowed to be discussed or aired, or you face, consequences in terms of your career or your job or just your standing and so forth. And this is a particular debate that, British and American universities are having as well about kind of free speech and, is there increasing kind of shutdown of certain issues as well. And it's, certainly as an academic.
Absolutely.
On my mind as well.
Yeah, and it kind of does, has an effect of almost discrediting some of the institutions that we've long looked up to and the publications and the people doing studies. And I think that the idea of people can't have open discourse and a free exchange of ideas has really done a lot of damage to our trust in people that we've long trusted. And that, I think, is terrible. And I don't know what kind of effects that will have in the future, but you're seeing that in Britain
as
well.
Yeah, I mean, in institutions which were once regarded as highly respected and kind of impartial are now seen, especially on the right, as being sort of politicized and kind of are left-leaning, in some cases radically left-leaning. So it's a shame. It's like we're seeing kind of alternative parallel institutions, as a kind of a rival to existing institutions. And it just seems that left and right, aren't talking to each other in the way in which we did, as I said, like 20, even 10 years ago, 20 years ago. It's sad because, I think, one of the joys of debate is debating with people that you disagree with.
It'd be a very boring debate if everybody disagreed with each other. I don't think anybody would watch that. That brings me to one of my next questions about sort of the importance that we place on history, especially in the military. Do you think that there's enough, there's all these lessons of what caused wars and the fallout and this is a bad idea, this is a good idea. Do you think that today's current military system in Britain places enough importance on historians to kind of consult, or kind of how in depth do people have to know, generals and the like have to know history when they make these decisions, these policy decisions?
I think it's a good question. And I think the answer is quite complex. In some respects, I think there is some experience there in government and in parliament. I don't know too much about the new intake of MPs yet, because we had we just had an election and we had a massive turnover of MPs. But certainly we do get some MPs with good military experience or interest in defence. I don't think it's correct to say that that doesn't exist. There is a cadre of MPs with that experience. And the last, in terms of the last government, actually, in terms of just before they left government, and the Conservatives, they conducted a refresh of their foreign and defence policy, the integrated review. And that process was actually led by a historian, John Bew. But that's rare to have a historian kind of to lead on something like that. So in that sense, that's good. But I think for the most part, there is a general kind of ignorance of history. Defense military affairs is not generally a high issue on the political agenda here. It is mostly the economy, health, you know, health especially, education, immigration, crime, is mostly domestic issues. We only really talk about foreign affairs when there's a war on, but we don't really talk about defense and much, and it's not much of a priority. So I think there is a you know, work to be done in terms of our establishments gaining both historical knowledge and knowledge of security and military affairs in particular.
And it seems like it would kind of not work out anyways, probably, if you think about the slow pace that government moves already. If you added debates about history, like this is how it was in history, and that would turn into its own bureaucratic thing, and everybody just taking up time with that anyways.
It did trigger something. We are increasingly having debates about history, but not necessarily kind of straightforward military history. In terms of our political discourse. So as in the United States, you know, slavery is becoming a big issue here, and historical slavery, I mean the slave trade and Britain's role in the slave trade, and certainly historical topics are becoming, you know, it's like, you know, they're becoming like culture war. I don't know if you've got the expression culture war there, but history is being used in the culture war sense. So the slave trade, you know, should Britain pay reparations to, you know, for, you know, former colonies? That's been in the news this week. The British Empire, again, should, you know, should we apologize for empire? Should we atone for empire? Should we again pay reparations for empire as well? And again, that's part of the polarizing debate, as I mentioned earlier as well. As, you know, there's strong opinions on both sides there. So yeah, I should have mentioned also, kind of, yes, there are other historical issues that are being discussed, but they're not being discussed in kind of a rational way. They're being used as a kind of political football, a culture war football, and you're right there to say, you know, sometimes the injection of history into our politics is not necessarily a good thing.
One of the questions I really wanted to ask you about was again, we're studying the American Revolution, so I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about the difference between today's type of soldier, which sort of changed after the Napoleonic Wars, where you got this kind of heroic patriot fighting for your country, versus before that, like in the American Revolution, where that sense of patriotism, at least among the British, didn't seem to exist. They were kind of hired guns that were kind of exhausted, and they fought well, but I kind of wanted to ask you your opinion about that, the difference in the type of soldier, and if they had been the type of soldier we have today, could that have affected the outcome of the war, the American Revolutionary War, if British soldiers were kind of, you know, the guerrilla warfare patriot, you know, kind of movie-esque?
Yeah, I mean the British had, you know, a kind of a mixture of, you know, it was a, you know, professional sort of regular standing army, but they also had mercenaries as well, you know, in particular German mercenaries, and actually the interesting thing about the British experience is that the British maintain that, so even during the Napoleonic Wars, they do not succumb to the you know, the kind of mass conscription that obviously the French had adopted, but also the continental powers would eventually adopt. The British would eventually adopt conscription in the First World War in 1916. So the British has always been kind of resistant to that kind of, you know, mass conscription, kind of, you know, mass citizen armies. It's only in the 20th century where that's happened. Would But as you write, the armies of the 18th century, you know, they tended to be kind of, you know, professional, a mixture of professional, mercenary, you know, we're not talking about raising kind of, again, mass conscript armies. Whereas, you know, from the French Revolution onwards in Europe, you know, you had the levy en masse and you had mass conscription and you had, you know, patriotic kind of feeling from the French Revolutionary Wars onwards, though you do have a period in the early 19th century where they tried to turn the clock back and you had a mixture of professionals and some conscription. But towards the end of the 19th century, when you have nationalism, when you have social Darwinism, conscription on the continent sort of came back. So those are the key differences. Would, you know, a British, you know, would a kind of a British kind of conscript kind of patriotic army have made the difference in the American War of Independence? It's difficult to say because it's, you know, because that was a rebellion. So
yeah,
it's hard to say in you know, because it's, you know, they're on the side of kind of, you know, suppressing the rebellion. It's difficult from that sense, but the American will to fight was, you know, fighting for your rights, fighting for your nation, your nascent nation. Yeah. That's
we had that patriotic spirit. We were able to be like rah rah rah. We were very, very much kind of like the post-Napoleonic soldier, like today's soldiers, with where we're really fighting for our rights in our country.
I mean, when you're fighting for that kind of cause, that is a very difficult cause to fight against. However, I don't think it was a foregone conclusion. I don't think, you know, British defeat and American independence was a foregone conclusion. There were problems in the Continental Army as well, and there were you know one of the British objectives was blockade, and the Continental Army had problems with, you know, supply, with weapons, with arms, and sometimes morale as well. They had problems with that, I think a key
was damn loyalists.
Yeah, man. And the fact that you've got, you know, it's, you know, there was a civil war dimension to that as well. But the other key elements is, of course, British strategy. Did the British adopt the right strategy in that war? Was the focus on capturing cities the right, you know, the right way of conducting that war? Should they have gone to try and destroy the Continental Army? And also a key element in the war was, of course, foreign intervention, the intervention of the French, the Spanish, and the Dutch, and the French in particular. Again, you know, extremely key. It ultimately made Britain's war, you know, immensely more difficult because it wasn't just the American dimension. The British, you know, faced the threat of invasion from the French. And Gibraltar was under siege as well, and you also had a war in the Caribbean as well, and the Sugar Islands were a priority for Britain as well. Yeah. So Britain firstly didn't have the resources, you know, didn't raise sufficient resources to start with, but they were also spread, you know, to try and adjust and trying to keep together all of their different priorities as well. So I would take issue with the notion that, you know, American independence was inevitable. There are, you know, lots of other kinds of parts and other factors involved in the eventual American victory.
I agree with you on that, definitely. I think that typically when you see an army spread on multiple fronts like that, you're going to have difficulty, you're going to lose some of those fronts. So That I would agree with you on that. Would you say that the American Revolution, the warfare, was there anything that war changed about warfare? you typically see that in World War One or the Napoleonic Wars, but is there anything about the American Revolutionary War that changed
warfare? It is not really regarded as a war that, you know, that does, you know, change, you know, a great deal in terms of the history of warfare. It is, it's you know, a curious mixture. Of course, it's fought in North America. The armies had to make some adjustments, you know, to the terrain in relation to fighting in North America. But generally, it's, you know, especially if you look at the the recent literature on the war, you know, it's the general kind of view, certainly what I've read, is that, you know, the both the British and the Americans, you know, tried to, you know, emulate as much as possible methods and tactics that they were adopting on the continent. So linear formation, close order formations. There's a slight difference there. The battles were in more open formations because of the terrain. The role of cavalry and artillery is slightly less in North America. But generally it was regarded as kind of, a typical kind of 18th century style of warfare. There was obviously a guerrilla sort of dimension to the war in terms of, from the American point of view as well. I think that the perhaps in terms of innovation, I think the use of copper hull plating on the hulls of ships was an important kind of development. Yeah. So from that point of view, in terms of the war at sea, even in terms of the war at sea, the naval battles, and it's worth pointing out that the British did win the big naval battle at the end against the French, and the battle of the Saints in 1782. But ultimately, naval battles were fought, you know, typically along the lines of, you know, 18th century line of battle kind of navies where they kind of fired broadsides at each other. There was some tactical variation here and there, but essentially it conformed to 18th century kind of standards. Yeah. So that's generally, you know, not being a complete, you know, as this is not typically my period. But that's the impression I get in terms of how the American War of Independence fit into the overall kind of history of warfare. Although, of course, it does, you know, it does produce a rebellion. I suppose the main other thing you could say is the sheer cost of the war, the sheer strain that this places on its combatants, you know, Britain, but especially France. And yeah. You know, the strain of this war is a contributory factor that ultimately led to the French Revolution. So in that sense, you know, warfare, you know, throughout the 18th century was becoming more expensive. You know, the Seven Years' War, for example, placed, you know, huge strains as well on the combatants as well.
Part of what caused the American Revolution, the Seven Years. Yeah. One of the lesser known things about the American Revolution is that there were POW camps that were really hellish, very brutal. You can't unlearn some of the things that you learn about them. And that was on both sides, the British and the colonists. But today we sort of have these international groups that kind of regulate what you can and can't do in a prisoner of war camp. What would you say in the 18th century we might see in a prisoner of war camp that we are no longer allowed to do in warfare?
In terms of what I actually been reading just before this podcast, there's one article, the author has just kind of escaped me now, but it is interesting. The argument that was made there was that actually the British and the Americans, although you can, there are exceptions and there are, you know, certain exceptions there. Essentially, the both sides try to adhere to the conventions and laws of war at the time. And essentially, you know, for the most part, they try to treat the prisoners in accordance to those customs and conventions. Obviously, that's subject to debate, and people might kind of dispute that. But certainly, in terms of, you know, in terms of the more kind of modern, in a more kind of recent literature, that there was again this kind of emulation of different, of kind of the European kind of standards and, you know, styles. So in that sense, and from the British perspective, they didn't need to be, because this was a rebellion. So essentially there could be treatment, you know, more lax in terms of treatment there. But of course, there wasn't the kind of the laws that we see now in terms of, you know, treatment of prisoners of war, that they must be subject to humane sort of treatment and so forth. And there was variation of treatment, as I said, during the course of the War of American Independence. But the curious thing about, despite the fact that we have all of these conventions today regarding humane treatment and how to treat prisoners of wars and so forth, and the treatment of prisoners in the conflicts today, one thinks of especially the Russia-Ukrainian war and how the Russians are treating Ukrainian prisoners and so forth, just in conflicts generally all throughout the world, those standards are not adhered to. So it raises the question of, you know, how do we get nations to adhere to standards, you know, to those standards? So although the rules and regulations, they're codified and they're tight in the 20th century, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be adhered to, because, you know, the atrocities, you know, we've had, you know, there was an atrocity sort of last week from the Russians where they were, where they stripped Ukrainian prisoners of war and then shot them. So in terms of making the comparison between the 18th century and the 21st century, and indeed the 20th century, you know, despite the codification of laws and the Geneva Conventions and so forth, have things really improved? You know, certainly in the West, you know, we try our best to adhere to them, but of course not every combatant, you know, is a Western liberal democracy.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's really interesting. In some respects, it hasn't actually changed that much, and that's really tragic. Okay, so that's it for the history questions. I do have a question I like to ask all of my guests, where you study the 20th century warfare, I remember correctly. You focus that. Okay. So if you had to pick one era, if you could only live in or study either the Tudor era or the 20th century, which one would you choose?
Oh, wow. I was going to say 18th century, actually. I do find that period fascinating. You know, I've always found, for example, Frederick the Great, you know, a fascinating figure in a fascinating kind of military figure, and just how wars were fought there, and it's a very understudied kind of period of military history as well. Certain conflicts, I mean, American Revolution is studied a fair bit. So I would have, and it just seems a very interesting period as well to live in as well, with kind of the Enlightenment and all of the intellectual activity going along there. But I do like to answer your specific question. Is it the Tudors or the 20th century? The adventurous side to me would. I suppose I'd go for the Tudors, just because it's completely different and just
Literally everybody picks tutors.
But yeah, it's just, you know, and so, yeah, I like to go into London and always walk past the Globe Theatre. And of course, you know, being at that time and you know, going to one of Shakespeare's, you know, plays, you know, and at the actual time, I often try and learn like the handwriting of the period. But then I get distracted, I get too busy, and then I just kind of trying to forget, and then I just forget everything that I've learned. But one of these days, I'm going to crack kind of early modern English and actually learn. Because another kind of period that I'm fascinated in is actually the later 17th century and the Anglo-Dutch Wars. Those are fascinating conflicts.
Oh yeah,
but,
me
but
too.
The only reason why I didn't do my PhD on either the 17th or the 18th century is that I don't know the writing, you know, in terms of the 17th century. And in order to be good at 18th century military history, you have to be good at French. And again, I've attempted to learn French, but I keep getting distracted and then I forget everything. So until I mastered all of those, then one day I would like to conduct research in those areas.
Yeah, well, that's cool. Thanks for answering that random question. The last question is if there's anything you're working on right now that you want to kind of share or talk about, any project you're working on.
I'm currently writing a book on 20th century warfare. It is, you know, essentially a survey of the development of warfare in the 20th century. And it in particular looks at the interaction between technology and culture in shaping the character of the different wars, and essentially explores the question that I was talking about earlier, about kind of why warfare in this period has been so brutal, so ferocious, and why do, you know, despite at the end of the Second World War, again you have all of these lessons of the Holocaust and you know, again these conventions that have been building up, you know, why did kind of, despite the more limited wars of the latter half of the decade, you still had, you know, in terms of there weren't total wars, there weren't wars of necessarily mass world wars, atrocities, you know, persist as well. And it's those kind of questions that I kind of get into in
the
book.
Very cool. When can we expect that, do you think?
Probably maybe late 2025, possibly 2026, probably. But yeah.
Okay, definitely send me a message or something when that comes out. I'd love to read it. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you again for coming on the show, Dr. Chris Newton. I hope we have you on in the future. It was really a pleasure to talk to you.
No, thanks very much. And, you know, thanks for the invite. I really appreciate it. And it's been really great to talk to you as well.